baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and you fill in the blank. Summer and Chevy go together like road trips and sunshine. Check out the full line of Chevy SUVs and trucks at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealers today. Chevy, drive Chicago.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. During these days of talk about anchor babies and border walls, novelist Vanessa Diffenbaugh weighs in with We Never Asked for Wings, her second novel. It's a follow-up to The Language of Flowers. Vanessa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I mean, there is a sort of a timeliness to it, but not really. I mean, this isn't about anchor babies. It's about immigration issues and about people who deal on either side of that, correct?
Yeah, you know, I didn't actually mean to write a book about flowers, and I wrote a book called The Language of Flowers.
A lovely book, I should say.
And I didn't mean to write about immigration, and I wrote a book that's what people are talking about.
You didn't mean for it to be about immigration?
I didn't mean to. You know, I set my book in kind of a fictional East Palo Alto, you know, those communities where there's extreme wealth on one side and extreme poverty on the other, and I was interested mostly in schools and kids and how the educational inequality affects people. But I created this community of Mexican-American families, and I realized that it would just be untrue to pretend that everyone is documented. And so I made one of my main characters undocumented, not thinking that that would affect the plot. And in fact, it changes everything in the book.
Well, documented or undocumented, either way, it's an immigrant life, you know, and it's about the hurdles these women face. Mm-hmm. And it's about the kids, maybe mostly, but tell me about the moms. Let's start with Letty.
Yeah, so my mom read this book. She got about 3 chapters in. She slammed the book closed and said, "Are you ever going to stop writing about terrible mothers?" You know, my poor mother, she lives in a small town. She says she can't hold her head up around town. But, you know, for me, I think that really gets to the crux of it. I'm not interested in good versus bad. You know, I'm interested in what does it feel like to be struggling and to want to love your child and do what's best for them
well,
and not know.
We meet this woman, Letty, who had had 2 children by 2 different men, never married. She lived with her parents, and her mom basically raised her children. At the start of the book, her parents are back to Mexico, and she bolts.
Yeah.
She leaves her kids to chase her mother. I mean, that's the choice she makes. Eventually, she comes around a little bit, but that's where this woman Letty starts when we meet her.
Yeah,
very different woman is Carmen, who's Yesenia is her daughter. Tell me about Carmen.
So Carmen had a baby in Mexico and was in a very dangerous, violent situation and fled and came all the way to find the best hospital she could for her baby and arrived at Stanford University, you know, walking, injured with a hurt baby. And so she's the exact opposite. She was a teenager when she had her child, Yesenia, and she grew up very fast. Letty didn't grow up at all. And, you know, someone recently said to me, this book, We Never Asked for Wings, it's a coming-of-age story, but it's the mother coming of age.
Right. So you mentioned the title, We Didn't Ask for Wings. We can get back to economics and all of that first, but let's talk about birds and science, because a grandfather here is an artist with bird feathers, which I didn't know was an art form.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Yeah, so my husband and I lived in Mexico for a year after we got married. We both wanted to learn Spanish. He was in education and felt like that was going to be important for him in the work that he wanted to do in the world. So we moved to Mexico. And one of the things that we liked to do on the weekends when we weren't working was we traveled around by bus and just collected folk art from artists living in these little villages. And one of the towns we ended up in, we met a family called the Ole Ole family. And they'd been doing Mexican feather work for 4 generations. And, you know, they told us in Spanish that if a bird died anywhere in the state of Michoacán, it found its way to their doorstep. And I loved that. And I loved their work. It really looks like an oil painting. But if you get close, it's not brush strokes that you're seeing, it's feathers.
That's the grandfather of Alex, Letty's son, is the artist there. And those feathers end up playing a role in Alex's schooling as well. All right, so let's go back to school. East Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, that's set at the foot of the runway at San Francisco Airport. Is that reality?
Yeah, no. So I mixed things around a little bit just to create a fictional world.
Well, you can do that because it's fiction.
I can. It's fiction. It's
but
great.
But you taught at East Palo Alto.
I did. So after school, I went to school at Stanford, and Stanford is in Palo Alto, which is, you know, now where Facebook is, and it's the tech boom. It's extremely affluent. And right across 101, you could literally throw a rock over the freeway from one side to the other, is East Palo Alto, which is a very low-income community that struggled for many, many generations. And I taught there after I graduated from Stanford. And the thing that struck me about that community was, from the perspective of the children that I worked with, just how isolated it was. You know, it was geographically so close to everything you could ever imagine, all, you know, major research institutions and ideas and information. And these kids, it was just really when technology was starting to change everything, and nobody had computers, nobody had cell phones, nobody had access to any of that world on the other side of the freeway.
It was there that you started to become involved in foster parenting.
Mm-hmm.
You grew attached to some young girls there, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And they were being raised by their mother and their grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened to them?
What happened was, the mom had a drug addiction. She was very open about it. We tried to get her help a lot of times.
These girls were students of yours?
Yeah, they were students.
And they basically lived with you on the weekends in many ways.
They did, yeah. I had mentored them for about 4 years. I wasn't part of any kind of program, which meant that, you know, I was young and had absolutely no boundaries. And so they would, I'd pick them up on Fridays. I'd drop them off, you know, Sunday evenings. And the mom ended up disappearing about 3 years into our relationship. And the grandma said she couldn't raise them, and she handed them over to me. And, you know, I was 23 or so and was just dating my husband. And, you know, we loved these girls. Mm-hmm. We'd known them for 3 years. We'd spent so much time with them. But we had no legal right to them, as well as, you know, having no skills or ability to parent four. There were four girls. So we had to surrender them to the foster care system and then watched what they went through.
And they went through a lot.
They went through a lot.
When we met a few years ago, 4 years ago,
yeah,
it was after your book, The Language of Flowers. And that was about a young girl who aged out of foster care. That's become your real issue, isn't it?
Yes.
Tell me, is it the Camellia Network?
The Camellia Network. So when I sold this, my first book, and I sold it in this incredible way that I wasn't expecting, and realized that I was going to be traveling all across the country, and I found myself in rooms full of women and men who had read my book, had connected with the character, who wanted to know more about this issue of aging out, and really wanted to know what they could do to help. And so I started a nonprofit. It was very grassroots. I went from city to city, and I called local nonprofits, and I said, "Who do you know that's aging out, and what can we do to help them?" And then I tasked my readers with that.
So we should tell. So people, kids who are in foster care, once they reach a certain age, mm-hmm. they, quote unquote, age out.
Yep.
And then they're out.
They're out.
I mean, they're just out.
Yep.
There's no support.
Nope.
There's nothing. And the Camellia Network
yep.
tries to help
yeah.
those
so
kids
we,
find a life.
Exactly. We created a nonprofit that's really a technology platform where kids can tell their story, who they are, where they're going, what they need to be successful. And then they can register for things, just like a baby registry, for going to college, for, you know, having a baby. And then readers can log on, or anyone, and get them the things they need. We really have very exciting news, though, with Camellia Network. We were recently acquired by a nonprofit named Youth Villages. And they're out of Tennessee, but they serve kids in 22 states. And they have the best reputation of any organization in the country serving foster kids. And they're going to use our network as part of their vision for serving kids aging out. They also have a really successful hands-on program mm-hmm. that gives kids intensive support when they're aging out. And so our network will be an additional support. But I think people who have come to Camellia Network in the past have loved that they can do something simple and easily to directly affect a kid. And now we're part of an organization that's really going to provide the rest of what the kid needs. So it's very exciting.
How did you come upon the name?
Camellia Network?
Yeah.
So Camellia means my destiny is in your hands.
That's what the flower means.
Back
to the language of flowers.
Exactly.
This is wrong. We're talking too much about your first book.
Sorry.
And not about this one. No, it's my responsibility. But I'm interested in that. So you don't just do this. I mean, you live the life.
Mm-hmm.
You fostered nine
mm-hmm.
kids?
Yep.
All together? Do you have foster children now?
So my kids are all grown. I mean, I have two biological children that are still 7 and 9. But my big boys are now 23. Trayvon, who lived with us for 4 years, went to NYU and just graduated last May, which is very exciting. And then my other son is 25.
Donovan Ford. Donovan Diffenbaugh.
Donovan Diffenbaugh Ford, exactly.
I'm reading about you this summer, and you adopted a 25-year-old man.
We did.
You'd fostered him.
So he was never our foster son.
He was never your foster.
Never.
Okay.
But as we were talking about before, kids age out at 18, and this was Donovan's experience. He had gone into the foster system at 2 weeks old. He'd never been adopted, even though he's a healthy, beautiful, intelligent, loving young man. At 18, he aged out, and his foster mother had him pack up his things, and he was literally put out onto the curb. And so he stayed with us on and off for a number of years.
He met you through the Camellia Network? How did he meet you?
My husband was a principal.
Okay.
So
right.
he knew our family. We always took a special interest
the
in
different
my husband's
have
place.
A habit of picking up kids at the schools, don't
we do. So Donovan was one of those kids. He'd spent a lot of Christmases with us, and he continued to spend Christmas with us, and we got closer and closer over the years. And about 2 years ago, he started calling us Mom and Dad. He was 23. And he started talking about wishing he could change his name to Diffenbaugh. And I said, well, Donovan, if you want to change your name to Diffenbaugh, we should just adopt you. And he said he would really like that.
What is the point of adopting a 25-year-old man?
The point of adopting a 25-year-old man is just that he now officially has a family. So for the rest of his life, when he needs his mom and dad, he can call us. When he has kids, his children now have grandparents, and they wouldn't have had anyone before.
So it's more about the embrace than the law,
really.
It is.
It's about the emotional. You know, we had a big adoption party. My mother-in-law bought a bunch of cakes that said, it's a boy. You know, it's all the – you don't realize how important your family is, I think, until you don't have one. And for Donovan, you know, he'd spent his whole life wanting a family, and now he officially has one.
And look at how many families you've created and helped create. So congratulations.
Thank you.
How do people help the Camellia Network?
So we were.
Are you too big for us now?
Or? Oh, please. We need you more than ever, and here's why. So we were just acquired by Youth Villages, and we've changed our name to LifeSet Network because we're part of their LifeSet program that provides kids everything they need, completely intense program. The great thing about this for us is that we were really, really small. So 23,000 young people age out of the system every year. We only had successfully served about 300 or 400. And so Youth Villages has the kind of reach and has the support and the background and the infrastructure to help us scale. So we've just relaunched last week. We're going to increase our numbers of kids serving, and we need people more than ever to really go to our website, meet the kids. You know, I was just at an event in Chicago, and I met someone who had met me on Language of Flowers book tour, had given to the Camellia Network, picked out a young man, and that young man had written her back on our website, and she said she printed out his thank you note and carries it with her everywhere because
nice.
It meant that much to him and to her.
So again, how do people find the group?
It's LifeSetNetwork.org.